This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to elders past and present.
So, what day is it today?
I don't know, Thursday, Friday. One of those days with an iron.
When Ray and John Ingram set off on their yacht into the vast expanse of the Pacific Ocean, they're looking for some solitude in the wake of their son's tragic death.
Oh, look at that. First boat in 3 weeks.
But pretty soon, they're not alone. They come across a stranger, Huey Warriner, whose ship, named Orpheus, is sinking.
Who would have thought, right?
What's your trouble, Mr. Warriner?
Trouble? She's going down, that's the trouble.
He claims the crew all died from food poisoning. But all is not what it seems. When John decides to take a look at the damaged vessel, Huey, now alone with Ray, hijacks the couple's boat. Drama ensues as Ray seeks to tame Huey's erratic and volatile nature so she can get back to John, who remains stuck on the slowly sinking Orpheus. In this episode of Seeing Green, we're diving into Dead Calm, Philip Noyce's 1989 psychological thriller starring Sam Neill, Nicole Kidman and Billy Zane. We'll explore how its depiction of seascape relates to imaginaries about the ocean as both threat and refuge. We'll also touch on the connection between weather and mental health and the role of film in reflecting anxieties of living on an island continent. I'm joined for this chat by Dr. Fincina Hopgood, a senior lecturer in screen studies at the University of New England. Her work focuses on the portrayal of mental illness in film, and she's been involved in multiple collaborative projects exploring the intersection of media and mental health. Fincina, it's great to have you as part of Seeing Green. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Dylan. I'm delighted to be a part of it.
And so what led you to do this research in film and mental health?
So in the 90s, I was a freelance film reviewer and writer for the industry magazine Cinema Papers, which at the time was sort of like the leading industry magazine for Australian film. And I'd grown up in the industry. My dad is a writer and an actor. And so it was sort of natural that I always had a passion for Australian film. But once I discovered that passion through writing and through journalism on the side of my undergraduate studies, I suddenly thought, wow, I could actually make this my career if I'm lucky enough. So I started thinking about doing a PhD, and I obviously wanted to continue my connections with the Australian film industry through my PhD research, but I was looking for a topic that really hadn't been explored. And it suddenly occurred to me that there'd been a sort of a swathe of films in the 1990s exploring issues of mental health. And you think about films like Shine, but also Angel Baby, Cozzy, Lillian's Story, and Angel at My Table, which of course is an Australian-New Zealand co-production. And I suddenly had this wonderfully rich collection of texts that I could really delve into for my PhD. So that all started in the 2000s for me. And it's just grown since then because, of course, we have a much greater awareness now of mental health issues, thanks to a lot of awareness raising, but also the really important advocacy work of mental health communities and particularly people with lived experience. So I've just continued to grow and to learn in that area. And it's through collaborations that I hope I'm continuing to learn more and more about mental health issues and to really bring to the table what screen studies can contribute to these discussions.
Yeah, really important research area and one that obviously has real world application as well. I suppose if we think about depictions of mental health in film, is weather and the environment much of a focus, generally speaking?
It's going to become more of a focus, actually, Dylan. It's a really great question. I think much of our previous frames of mental health have been very much focused on the individual and how that person is coping or not coping with their everyday environment. We're now beginning to look more broadly at the sort of the structural systemic issues that contribute to mental ill health, and weather and climate change is one of them. And I'm actually working with some really fantastic, exciting research. One of my PhD students at University of New England, she's looking at how the manifestation of eco anxiety, which we now talk about, you know, throughout the media and throughout coverage of natural disasters, how eco anxiety is actually seeping into the cultural product through some of the stories we're telling in film and TV today. So I honestly think the issue of the environment and climate change actually goes hand in hand with notions of mental health, mental wellness, and a broader collective sense of what it means to be mentally healthy.
Well, so grateful to be able to draw on your expertise for today's discussion. Thanks once again for joining us. Also joined today by Dr. Killian Quigley, a research fellow at the Institute for Humanities and Social Sciences at the Australian Catholic University. Killian has expertise in marine and maritime humanities, among other things. He's published widely on such topics as the literature of sea level rise, shipwreck narratives, and the poetry of submarine science. And this, of course, makes him a prime candidate for today's episode. Killian, welcome. We're so pleased to have you on the podcast.
It's a privilege to be here, Dylan. Thanks a lot.
And I've had a crack at summing up your work in a relatively short space of time, but I'm not sure how well I did. How would you describe your research interests and background?
What I'm really interested in at the moment in my research, and what's been preoccupying me for some years now, are the ways in which oceanic spaces challenge certain conventions in the ways that we tend to tell stories, make art, describe and inhabit space, narrate change, etc., etc. With work that I've done on projects like the aesthetics of the undersea, what I've been interested in doing is thinking about what happens if we take, for example, the last several years of cultural history in the West and submerge it. That is to say, what happens to the categories that we rely on to interpret and describe terrestrial experience if we take them out to sea, or perhaps even more provocatively, if we take them undersea. This has taken me toward narratives of anthropogenic sea level rise, something that it strikes me also connects to the fascinating work that Francine has just been describing about eco-anxiety. I've been really interested in shipwrecks, in salvage, in the relationship between marine and maritime disaster, and the histories of things like marine science. And I'm also really interested in the ways that these phenomena intersect with geopolitics.
Yeah, very grateful to have you involved as part of this episode of Seeing Green as well. Without further ado, let's pull up the anchor and set sail on our discussion of Dead Calm. Fincina, I wonder if you could contextualise this film for us in terms of its place in the Australian film industry in the late 1980s.
It's a really important turning point in the Australian film industry, coming out of the 80s, the era that was known as the 10BA tax scheme, in which there was a lot of incentivisation by the government for private investment, and there was a huge boom in very commercially oriented film production. But that was being wound up by the end of the 80s, and as we move into the 90s, it's a really interesting period of Australian film production where there are these two, I guess, tensions that the Australian film industry is navigating between telling very commercially oriented films that are targeted towards an international market, which was certainly the case for the many of the 10BA commercially oriented films that wanted to get a return on their investments. And this ongoing impetus to forge and continue to develop a sense of what is a national cinema and how do we tell our own stories. And I think Dead Calm is a fascinating text for that intersection of those sometimes conflicting, but often, in this case, coalescing impulses to tell Australian stories with an eye to the international commercial market. And I think that's a really interesting thing to bear in mind with Dead Calm coming in 1989, before we move into the 1990s and we get kind of a new wave of Australian films which are very outward looking in their ambitions. And the film is both recognisably Australian to Australian audiences. Of course, you've got Nicole Kidman's accent when she's barely 20 years old in this role, and it's lovely hearing that naturalised accent.
You know what I'd love for lunch? Fresh asparagus.
But you've got that recognisable horizon, the blue horizon of the Australian environment and the landscape, which we, if we've grown up in this island continent, can recognise as our own, particularly if we are familiar with that coastal area around the Whitsundays and the Great Barrier Reef, which is where it was filmed. So there are markers of Australian national identity that we can trace, but at the level of genre, it's very clearly an internationally oriented genre pick. It's a psychological thriller. And of course, it has the villain, the antagonist character, very explicitly coded as American through the accent of Billy Zane.
My name is Huey Warner. I only bought her about 3 months ago.
And what was absolutely fascinating was the notion of this being an Australian film was not remarked upon at all. It was simply taken as this, you know, psychological thriller of three people in a boat at sea. And what struck me was that kind of universal appeal of the basic premise of what would you do in the situation of Ray and the Samuel character. And I think that's so interesting for us to think about, is how the film appeals to an international audience and an Australian audience simultaneously. And it's sort of a shame that the film's sort of been forgotten. I think it's gradually being recuperated through people going back through the archive of Australian film and recognising that this was a really commercially ambitious, polished product that spoke to a whole range of audiences in interesting ways.
Yeah, and worth noting, I suppose, that this is based on a 1963 book, Dead Calm, by American crime author Charles F. Williams, and was the basis of an unfinished Orson Welles film as well, yet it appears as an Australian film directed by Philip Noyce. It has been praised for its oceanic cinematography. Killian, I'm interested in your perspective as a non-film scholar. Can you describe how this film looks in terms of the seascape, and I suppose what makes it so eerie in the way that the ocean is depicted as part of the plotline?
Yeah, the question of place and oceanic place seems really important, as Fincina's already sort of drawn our attention to. For me, as a non-Australian, but as someone who lives and works in Australia and has, you know, some awareness of relationships between Australian national identity and the ocean, I was fascinated and, to be frank, perturbed by the kind of place-less character of seascape in most of this film. If I'm not mistaken, the only kind of glancing reference that we get to a kind of marine location in the film comes from Huey, Billy Zane's character, saying something like, "We're on our way from Papeete, French Polynesia, to Fiji."
32 days out, we're bound for Papeete. I'm heading for Fiji.
My plan had been to cruise around the Pacific, to sail around the Pacific.
Which puts us really sort of far out, as it were, into the middle of the Pacific. The Pacific Ocean in particular, for hundreds of years in a kind of Western cultural history, have functioned as sort of emblems of placelessness, right? Of emptiness. This place that is represented as being truly in the middle of nowhere isn't the middle of nowhere for all peoples or all cultures, right? So even there's something worth asking about how does this one idea of locating the story in the sort of great blue beyond relate to other ways that we might have decided to conceive of or relate to a place like this. The ocean is quite two-dimensional in this movie, and that seems really important for the story and for some of its themes. But we almost never go underwater, which feels really important for a lot of what this film is doing and a lot of the things that it's interested in. There's an interesting sort of scholarship around this in environmental history, in sort of, you know, ocean studies literatures that addresses what some scholars see as the problem of treating oceans as only a kind of air-sea interface, that is, only as a sort of space that one moves across, as opposed to thinks of more sort of voluminously, if you will.
So much to unpack there. Fincina, would you like to pull on some of those threads?
Oh, I absolutely love those threads that you've thrown out to us to catch, Killian. It's fantastic. There were two really interesting points that you raised that I actually thought similarly to you. I'm not an ocean studies person like you are, but it really did strike me, the representation of the ocean as predominantly a flat surface. We do get some storm and some threatening waves menacing towards the end of the film, which very nicely coincides with the narrative climax of the film. But the visual aesthetics of the sea is predominantly this flat, almost desolate seascape, which I couldn't help but think, particularly early on when there's a chase sequence between the two boats, I couldn't help but thinking, oh, it's Mad Max at Sea, because I knew it was like a Kennedy Miller production, of course. And there is a very exciting chase sequence very early on between the two boats, and thinking, will the boat, you know, captained by Sam Neill, which we know is leaking water, will it catch up to the boat in which Huey, played by Billy Zane, has taken Nicole Kidman's character Ray effectively hostage? So it's a wonderfully tense moment, but it's literally like seeing these boats glide on this glassy surface of the ocean as if it were the desolate, vast outback landscape of Australia. So it really brought to mind this idea of the vastness and the emptiness with which we conceive of the Australian natural environment, which is traditionally inward looking. This time it's more outward looking. And it did strike me in particular the almost complete absence of marine life in the film. There's only one sequence in which Sam Neill's character is increasingly submerged in this boat that's taking on water, and he sees some fish, and that gives him an idea of a way out of his predicament. Right. But even in a scene where he falls over the boat and he's, you know, cut his arm and there's blood in the water, the camera is actually underwater looking up at him in that quintessential Jaws point of view shark shot. And I thought, oh, here comes the shark, and you don't see it. So it was really striking to me, the evacuation of marine life from the seascape and the relative surface level of the representation, as you say, of the ocean, which made me reflect upon what that tells us about how we see the natural environment in Australian film more broadly. We see it in terms of what is the level of intersection between the human subject and the environment. And anything that's below that, that doesn't involve the human subject, is not interesting to the filmmakers, understandably, because it's a human drama that just happens to be set on an ocean. But that ocean is about making them feel isolated, vulnerable, and, you know, at the mercy of that isolation and the elements.
I think that that link with Mad Max that you make is so interesting, Fincina, in relation to the sort of flat surface, the vastness of the ocean, which has real parallels with the way the outback is often depicted in seminal Australian films such as Mad Max, you know, Wake in Fright, both of which we've looked at in this podcast series. But also thinking about our most recent episode, The Back of Beyond, a John Heyer's landmark documentary about a mailman's journey across the Birdsville track. There's one point where the narrator refers to the vast ocean of sand in the outback. So even making these links with, you know, the ocean that existed in these places many, many years ago. Killian, I'm interested in your perspective on whether there was sort of a fundamental shift at all in the way that Australia might have started to lean in more to the coastal as a signifier of national identity away from the outback, which has been presented so many times in particularly Australian new wave film coming from the 1970s onwards.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Fincina's just sort of pointed us toward this, and Fincina may well be more expert in this topic than I am. But I'm interested in this idea of a sort of pivot from sort of interior or inward-oriented cultural consciousness towards something more outward-looking, a way of looking, a gaze that is situated at the margins of a continent and oriented outwards, a look that perforce then incorporates the beach and the sea beyond it. And I'm interested in histories of exploring what that sort of a pivot does, not only for forms of pleasure and desire, of course, but also for ideas of fear, of threat, and so forth.
Yeah, how would you respond to that, Fincina?
So the coastline is very central to that conceptualization of a modern Australian identity that many of us have either experienced as tourists or have grown up in. And what's really striking, again, with Dead Calm is it's set on the ocean, but it's nowhere near the coastline. And one of those markers of national identity, those visual markers of national identity that we associate with beach culture in Australian film and television, is absent from this film. So that's one of the reasons it's a very flexible text to be read by Australian viewers and by international viewers, because it doesn't presume to have that, I guess, cultural knowledge of being predominantly coastal dwellers. But I think that erasure, if you like, of that obvious visible marker of the Australian identity through the coastline, now cast adrift, if you like, on the ocean, is another way of thinking through Australia's place in the world at this point, both in the film industry, but also in terms of how it was positioning itself geopolitically going from the late 80s into the early 90s. And there was a bit of commentary around the time of Dead Calm, which looked at the fact that people were anxious about what is the place of the Australian film industry in relation to international cinema, and should we be merely copying the American model and pursuing genre models, or should we be looking for our own distinctive voice? And I think, I don't know the backstory behind why Billy Zane was cast as the interloper or the antagonist, but his obvious American identity for me registers that cultural anxiety about the influence of foreign culture and the threat to the little nuclear family that is represented by Ray and John on board the boat. And in that sense, the film has been open to those multiple readings in terms of the anxieties of place and the anxieties of national identity and what it means for not only the industry moving forward, but also how it reflects upon our status as an island continent. You know, that idea of us being cut off from the world, down the bottom of the globe, this land down under, if you will, the underside of the Northern Hemisphere, visually reflected through the seascape that we see in Dead Calm.
Yeah, and I think that's so interesting in light of the sort of dualism in the way that the ocean is presented in this film. It is very much depicted as a threat, and there's a certain anxiety layered across the fact that these people need a boat to survive, basically. And the whole drama of the film is John stuck aboard the Orpheus and trying to keep it afloat for as long as possible so Ray can get to him. But near the beginning, after Ray has a nightmare about her dead child, John comes in to console her and says, "We've got weeks and weeks of calm days, calm seas. Now we're going to get strong. And when we're strong, then we'll go home and start again."
"Now look, we've got weeks and weeks, calm days, calm seas. And we're going to get strong. And when you're strong, then we'll go. And we'll start again."
So the ocean and being away from land is therefore depicted almost as a refuge, as something they need to do to rehabilitate. But it also is the source of great anxiety and a place where Billy Zane's character, Huey, suffers some form of mental deterioration. How do you reflect on that, Killian, in light of the way that imaginaries have been placed on the ocean in relation to humans?
From the beginning, you know, for me, this rings really ironically, because one of the ways in which we could characterize long stretches of calm seas is in terms of the doldrums, a windless state of being at sea that has really haunted marine and maritime literatures and art for hundreds of years. Fencina drew our attention, I think, really helpfully to the different ways in which this film represents mobility and the importance to this film of moving at various speeds across oceanic space, or the oceanic stage, we might even like to say. The doldrums represents a fantasy or a nightmare of motionlessness, right? Of being deprived of mobility by the very environment that you're using to travel across space. So it seems like from the very beginning, there's an interesting tension there between the idea of seeking solitariness, seeking refuge in order to process grief and trauma, and on the other hand, the idea that a dead calm is something in which one festers, one lingers, with potentially disastrous consequences.
Yeah, would you like to pick up on that, Fencina?
Absolutely, Killian. I think that's a fascinating reading of the relationship we have with the space of the ocean in this film and its kind of healing potential as well as its anxiety-inducing potential. It's such a multifarious mode of thinking about our relationship with the environment. I wanted to pick up on your point about mobility also, because it made me think about Ray's journey through the film and her journey of recovery from trauma and grief through experiencing another kind of trauma. So she's lost her child at the very beginning of the film. We see that she's driving to pick up her husband John from the train station in the rain. And again, water is really prominent. The fact that she has a car accident in the middle of a rainstorm, I think, is interesting. And the film is quite graphic in its depiction of the car crash, and in particular, the death of their toddler son, which is understandably a deeply traumatic event for Ray. It's quite traumatizing for the film viewer. It's within the first few minutes you see this toddler fly through the car window. It's quite shocking. And the film has that kind of that residue of the Mad Max aesthetic in that opening sequence in the hospital, where John arrives in haste to see Ray being poked and prodded by doctors. And we know about, you know, George Miller's background as a medical doctor working in emergency wards. So the film opens with a scene of trauma for the character, and a film that is quite traumatizing for the viewer also. And then we have that period of the film where it's about being in the calm sea and that being seen as the place to heal and to recover. But you might recall that we're seeing Ray really immobilized in the ship. And I've always felt there's a paternalistic tone to the way John treats her in those early scenes. And he doesn't empower her to ask for what she needs to recover. He's telling her what she needs to do to recover from her trauma. And we then move into the second half of the film when they become separated. And Ray finds herself having to not only defend the ship and rescue John and, you know, beat off Huey, but she's having to make decisions for herself about how to look after herself physically, but also, as we see, obviously emotionally and mentally.
Don't make me.
What's gonna make you?
Stay there!
I just wanna talk!
And it's her psychological journey to recover from one form of trauma through experiencing, dare I say, another form of trauma, but actually, I guess, clawing back some agency of her own. And one of the most, I think, for me as a viewer, viscerally rewarding scenes in the film is actually seeing her steering the boat. It is her in the elements crashing through the waves. I totally believe the credibility of Nicole Kidman driving that boat, although I'm sure there was someone really in charge, but it looks fabulous. And here's this young girl in the elements pushing through the waves, going to rescue her husband. And it's that wonderful gender reversal there where initially he was trying to rescue her and now she's trying to rescue him. But it's a long sequence and you can tell that they've given her ample space to perform through her face, the myriad of emotions she's going through. The music is really quite important to underscoring that moment, and also the whole visual storytelling that's taking place. It's pretty blunt, but it's also pretty, I guess, for the viewer, it's really viscerally engaging that by going to rescue John, she's taking back some control. She's once again mobile. She's driving the boat the way she was driving the car when her son died, but in this time it's an opportunity for her to undo that and to face up to her fears. So for me, reading the mental health journey of Ray through her experiences of the environment, through her experiences of trauma, and trying to assert her own agency is really interesting.
Thinking about this film in today's context, I mean, this was filmed, I understand, in the Whitsundays near to the Great Barrier Reef, which is, of course, is subject to coral bleaching, damage induced by climate change and so on. Earlier, Killian, you talked about the threat from below the surface, which isn't really represented in this film, but we assume it's there through the framing of blood in the water at a few points in time. I wonder how you would reflect on that sense of threat from below the surface, applying today's lens in terms of the impact of climate change on coral reefs and also sea level rise and the impact that will have on countries, you know, places all around the world.
In terms of the film itself, I'm really interested in the transit, if you like, between John's efforts to keep the Hellship afloat in order, obviously, to convey himself toward Ray and therefore to try to effect at what is at that point presented as her rescue, but also as a way of keeping afloat testimony, evidence, information, the content of the backstory, the idea that only by keeping this stuff at the surface is that content actually going to persevere. That gets us toward an idea of the undersea as a space that erases, right? That once something goes underneath the waves, it is negated, right? It no longer exists. It seems significant that by the end, no, this stuff is going to get consigned to the undersea, right? In the end, it's going to get set on fire, right? And it's going to get sunk, right? If we think about the film as a psychological thriller, as a symbolic narrative in various and perhaps not altogether tidy ways, we might reflect on what's going on there, the idea that this kind of scene of horror, a scene of like truly disturbing sexualized violence, implicitly of young women who are sort of coded as a sort of an international coterie of beautiful, exploited young women. We might think about, you know, what it means that in the end, for the sort of film to move towards its resolution, all of that needs to be sunk. On the one hand, the idea, of course, that the sea exists beyond territory, beyond legal imaginaries, and so forth, is basically damaging for the ways in which we understand things like responsibility, things like community, the ways that we imagine the relationships between individual and collective behavior and consequence for the quote-unquote natural world. And in a practical sense, it's the sort of thing that allows, say, deep sea mining companies to operate not only beyond, sort of literally beyond our abilities to perceive what's happening, but also beyond the sorts of legal mechanisms, territorial mechanisms, and so forth that we might hope would leave us, and by us I mean sort of private citizens, with some degree of agency in the present and future of the oceans and their ecologies. So that's all to say, I suppose, that this sort of fantasy of the alien ocean, right? The ocean that might as well be sort of outer space is obviously really symbolically productive for a film like this. And I don't mean to suggest that like we can't explore that idea, because of course, as you've suggested already, Dylan, the ocean is other in ways that we're never simply going to overcome. All that said, right, it is something that I think we can recognize as a prompt to reflect seriously on the obstacles that we throw up to thinking more carefully about what's happening underneath the waves and the practices that we might undertake to adopt a slightly different relationship to them.
Yeah. And I mean, on that, it seems rare to view this film through an environmental lens. I've come across some articles that examine it from the perspective of genre as a psychological thriller, and some post-structuralist readings as well that really highlight the trauma and grief Ray experiences in the film. But if we think about fiction film as having a real role in highlighting some of the concerns that we very much have today around climate change, sea level rise, destruction of ecosystems, and particularly in relation to your research area, Fincina, eco-anxiety, which is something so many of us are going to continue to grapple with for some time, what role can feature films play in that regard, connecting us with these environments and grappling with the current and future state of things?
I'm really glad you asked the question about what is the role of screen media here, because we have to be conscious of the fact that screen media has the capacity to help us travel to places that we may not otherwise get to travel to physically, and particularly in this era when we're trying to minimise our carbon footprint with flying. And so it does have the capacity to give us access to incredible vistas such as the ocean as we see here, and to think and reflect about what is our role in protecting these oceans. Having said that, though, it's worth bearing in mind also that the film industry itself and the screen industry does have its own carbon footprint. And we have to be mindful, and I know there are people in the industry who are mindful of how can we continue that role of screen media in terms of giving people access to the natural environment through their screens in a way that is respectful and doesn't do further damage to that natural environment. So I think screen media is implicated in environmental damage as much as it can be used as a tool to raise awareness for and advocate for environmental protections and to actually advocate for climate action. So it's a very conflicted space, whether you're working in feature film production, television production, or documentary production. But I still think it is a very vital role that screen culture plays. And I did want to actually emphasise, I think, one of the aesthetic beauties of this film is the cinematography of the ocean. Dean Semler was the director of photography, and he'd worked on the Mad Max 2 film and other Kennedy Miller productions. And from this, he actually goes on to work in Hollywood. But in particular, he goes on to film and to win the Oscar for Dances with Wolves and becomes known as a location cinematographer. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the, I guess, not just the aesthetic pleasure, but the impact of widescreen cinematography and what it can do in terms of connecting us predominantly urban dwellers with a natural environment that we might have been disconnected from. So I think this idea of the greening of Australian cinema in both its screen industry practices and in terms of what it's showing us is something that's really, really exciting and shows the role that screen media can play, not just simply in having a commercial impact, but a cultural and social impact as well.
Well, that seems like a good point to drop anchor, if I can labour that metaphor one more time, end our conversation to ponder that thought. Thank you so much, Dr. Killian Quigley, Dr. Fincina Hopgood. It's been so wonderful having you part of Seeing Green.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been lovely to talk about this film and to hear about Killian's fascinating research. Thanks, Killian.
Yeah, likewise, Fincina. I've learned so much. Thanks a lot, Dylan. This has been really fun.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling and hosted by me, Dylan Bird. Follow, rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. In the next episode of Seeing Green, we head to the wilds of Tasmania on the trail of the thylacine.
We get a lot of tourists this way looking for the Tassie tiger.
All the scenes are quite ugly and confronting, and that stands in contrast to the landscapes of the natural environment, those long shots of something more beautiful.